The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2023, Charting the Course, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join. or by making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, please visit libraplanet.org/conference.
She's a researcher and educator who's worked across universities, community colleges, academic libraries, and industry to promote technical literacy focused on ethics, user governance, and community values. She currently works as a developer educator at a software supply chain security startup. So take it away.
Thank you. Whoa, loud. That's okay. All right. Good morning. No, good afternoon. How is everyone doing? Woo! It's really, really great to be here. Is this the first in-person Libra Planet in 3 years? Is that correct? In four? Oh my gosh. Awesome. And first, I just want to give a round of applause to the organizers, the volunteers, the tech team that has brought us together today and is heroically navigating some technical issues. So thank you so much. Just to get it out of the way, yes, I am 7 months pregnant. You know, I don't want you wondering that the whole talk. Don't worry, I'm putting her to work. She promised she would kick me if I accidentally say open source instead of free software. Wish me luck. I'm kidding, I'm not gonna do that. But seriously, it's an honor to be here with such an incredible community. A community that profoundly changed the way that I think about technology and education. At the moment, I work in a software supply chain security startup, but I spent a decade working in higher education as a researcher, an educator, and a technologist. And one of the things I focused on while there was advocating for more ethical forms of software in research and teaching. So I'm basically building off of Nicholas's wonderful talk that we just heard. And I come here today as a messenger because I think what's happening in higher education is extremely relevant to this community's future. It's relevant to charting the course of free software. And I have some bad news, unsurprising to you all, because you all saw this coming for decades, right? But still, it's not so great. There are some disturbing trends in educational technology that should have us all deeply worried, and we're going to talk about those today. But more importantly, I want to make you aware of some of the lesser-known edtech projects that I think powerfully enact some of the ideals of this community. These are projects that I think need more support and visibility, especially from us, because what I hope to convince you of today is that a large part of the future of software freedom will be won or lost in the classroom. And so I'm starting this talk with an image from the artist Diane Twombly's Improbable Landscapes and Precarious Dream States. And one, I just think it's a lovely image. We don't look at art enough, so you know, soak it in. But two, this image represents how I sometimes feel about software freedom, that it's a precarious dream state. You know, one whose beauty and importance I deeply believe in, but yet feels almost impossible in today's mainstream software culture. Software freedom, right? The right to run, modify, copy, share source code. It's a really powerful idea. And yet it can be difficult to commit to, myself included, right? Because we live in a world where using free software often goes against social, professional, and consumer norms. It can be difficult to do. It takes work. The value isn't always clear to folks who don't have the skills to study or modify code themselves. And let's be honest, that's all of us, given the complexity of today's software systems. And yet for everyone in this room, this freedom means something. For some reason, everyone here, I hope, has experienced why this freedom is important, why it makes a difference. I want you to take a moment and just think about what that experience was for you. Who were you with? Where were you? Was it a community project? Was it an academic project? Was it in a classroom? Like, seriously, think about it right now. When you've thought of it, can you just give me a little thumbs up? And can you give your neighbor a thumbs up? And your other neighbor a thumbs up? Awesome. Okay, keep that memory in mind, because we're going to come back to it. The question I've been interested in is, how do we teach that experience to others? Does anyone know that story about the sun and the wind competing to take the man's jacket off? No? Okay. Well, the sun and the wind get together, and they decide to have a competition. They say, we're going to try to take, one of us is going to try to take that man's jacket off. And so the wind starts, and the wind blows and blows and blows. And guess what the man does? He just holds onto his jacket tighter. In higher education, I often felt like the wind. I would tell students, you shouldn't use unfree software because it's unethical, it's exploitative, it's controlling, it's surveillance, huff, puff. And you know what the students did? They nodded very politely and they held onto their unfree software just as tightly. Does anyone relate to this? Yeah, okay, not just me. I think you're seeing this at a broad scale, right? It's not just in the classroom. We have activists, we have researchers, we have journalists, we have artists, we have tech ethics groups, we have dystopian television shows, we have the Free Software Foundation. We have you all bringing public awareness to the many ways our everyday technology surveils and manipulates human beings. And yet we're not making enough progress on these issues, right? Huff. Puff, and the world just holds on to its unfree software even tighter. So what's missing here? If the coat is unfree software, what can get someone to take it off? Where can we most effectively intervene? That's what we're going to talk about today. But first, some housekeeping. Okay, this talk is part of an educational experience, so we're going to need to use some basic educational tools to facilitate our learning. And don't worry, these are standard tools used by thousands of students, or millions of students actually, at thousands of universities across the globe. And the first is the learning management system. Who's here has used the learning management system, right? Don't worry if you haven't, it's really straightforward. It's just a cloud-based tool that allows educators to share course materials and students to submit homework. And it's pretty cool, right? Most people don't know this, but it records every interaction you have with it, all your keystrokes, even words you've deleted, or your online activity. And then magically, it uses this data to generate brilliant learning analytics that the university can use to assess your potential and direct your education. Next up, plagiarism detector. This tool has revolutionized fairness. The plagiarism detector, we'll use this just in case we do a writing assignment. And this tool, how it works is it ingests millions of student papers and compares them to each other and other text databases to make sure no one is cheating. It also makes grading such a breeze for me. I hardly even have to read student papers anymore. And it's it's pretty neat for students too, right? Just imagine everything you've ever written for school sitting on this company's servers doing such important fairness work. Wow. And thanks to incredible progress in facial recognition technology, I will be able to test you on today's lecture from the comfort of your own home using a remote proctoring tool. So basically, this tool will just scan your room and your face and track your eye movement while you take a test to make sure you're not cheating. And don't worry, you know, if the tool makes a mistake, I or another administrator can watch the recording, you know, just to make sure everything is fine. And that's pretty fun for me because then I get to see, you know, the inside of your bedroom or wherever you take the test. One last tool for extra credit, you can also help test out these new EdTech headbands that track your engagement by analyzing your brain waves. This one's not mandatory today, but who knows, maybe it will be tomorrow. Just think about how much more effective I could be at teaching you if I had continuous real-time data about your inner psychological state. Okay, so before we proceed, I just need everyone here to just agree to using these terms. Everyone okay? Can you just, I got the finger, huh? Okay, yeah, is that, that wasn't a yes? Okay, just some head nods, just like, you know, because I actually can't continue this unless we agree to use these tools. Yeah, okay, all right, so is there a problem? Okay. Nope, that's too fast. Okay, of course, I'm kidding. I'm not going to make you use these tools. But had you been one of millions of students around the globe whose institutions use these tools, your refusal might mean that you would no longer be able to participate in that institution of schooling. For many students and educators, these tools are mandatory. And they are mandatory despite being publicly known to surveil students and use student data in exploitative ways. The Human Rights Watch Group found that 89% of the EdTech tools endorsed by the world's most populous governments during the pandemic surveilled children outside of student hours and sold student data to marketers and data brokers. 89%. Student data is extraordinarily valuable, and this was the case long before the pandemic. Back in 2013, the McKinsey Global Institute estimated that student data alone could unlock as much as $1.2 trillion annually. And soon after, you see the value of this data manifest in the multi-billion dollar sales of major ed tech companies, like the plagiarism detection software Turnitin, or Instructure, a leading learning management system. By 2019, journalists were beginning to note that the prevalence of these tools were turning institutions of education into giant surveillance machines. And here is a major ed tech in 2019, where a journalist observed that the EdTech tools on display were aiming to track and analyze every move by students and professors in the name of efficiency, with some even tracking students long before and long after their enrollment in the institution. There's no shortage of reporting here. For the past several years, student surveillance has been in the headlines of major publications. And you don't have to be a free software advocate to see these trends as deeply disturbing. In a way, there's cold comfort here. 15 years ago, most folks weren't too concerned about digital surveillance. So in some ways, it's good to see broader public recognition of the problem. But despite this recognition, student surveillance persists. And what's more, surveillance is just one of the many problems we're seeing with educational technology. The other problems, sadly, don't get as much media attention. Am I doing something? Should I? All right. Give me tips if you have any. So if you dig beyond the surveillance reporting, you'll see that educators and researchers are in fact concerned about a broad set of ethical issues related to ed tech that includes but goes far beyond surveillance. For instance, there are critics rightfully questioning the pedagogical value of these tools. Are these tools actually helpful for learning, or are they really designed to manage students and extract data? Unfortunately, there's substantial research demonstrating that these tools are often in conflict with good pedagogy. Educators have also pointed out the way that these tools discriminate against specific groups of people or exacerbate existing inequalities. Chris Gilliard has written about how these tools often enact what he calls digital racism by limiting students' financial and intellectual opportunities based on their race or class. Others have pointed out how plagiarism detection tools are actually hypocritically profiting off of student data without crediting them. In effect, the plagiarism detection tools are plagiarizing student writing themselves. It gets worse. These tools and these companies are known to enable abusive behavior towards academic communities. For example, learning management systems have been abused by university administrations to suppress dissent and spy on students during academic strikes and collective bargaining. And some of these tools have expressed open hostility towards students, gleefully flaunting their control over student machines. And here, a student that was using the proctoring tool Proctorio tweeted what happened when he opened Chrome DevTools while using the Proctorio tool. A message popped up saying, "Smile, whoops, you just tried to hack this tool and you were caught. Your IP has been locked and evidence is being forwarded to your school administrator." Boo. And there are many folks working in higher education that are afraid to speak out, given that edtech companies have a record of suing their critics, such as in the case of Ian Linkletter, an educational technologist who spoke out against proctoring tools and has been involved in a costly multi-year lawsuit with an edtech company ever since. Once you start looking at these issues, you can see that the problem with edtech isn't just surveillance, but that in many cases, edtech is gutting student and educator autonomy from higher education. These tools are effectively replacing cultures of learning and community with cultures of distrust, management, and surveillance. So how should we think about these problems? Obviously, there are social, political, and economic dimensions underlying each of these issues, which are important to understand when considering solutions. But I also think looking at these issues through the lens of free software can be particularly illuminating. Instead of seeing these problems as diverse individual issues, we can look at them as systematic of a larger overarching problem. These students, educators, and academic workers are denied software freedom. They do not have the right to understand and control their tools, and so they don't have the power to prohibit some of these forms of surveillance and control. In fact, I think the problem is much worse than that. I think higher education has normalized a culture of software oppression. Paulo Freire, a wonderful philosopher of education, viewed oppression as the systematic denial of a people's right to critically understand and transform their world. And this is what we're seeing in educational institutions, the systematic denial of the academic community's right to understand and transform the digital infrastructure that shapes their research and teaching. This isn't just about closed code. This is about a culture that makes it almost impossible to imagine the possibility and value of software freedom. Higher education has become a place where students learn that software oppression is normal and natural, both in school and in the world at large. And there is research that provides evidence for this. Students have become so resigned to digital surveillance that many of them think criticism of surveillance is akin to conspiracy theories. Now, of course, there are examples of software oppression everywhere. It's obviously not just in schools. But education is particularly important because it is where millions and millions of people, at least in North America, form their technological consciousness. As many tech giants know, education is a key site for selling tech products and services, developing brand loyalty, and capturing the consumer market. It is a place where tech customers are won for life. And Steve Jobs said it himself, universities buying Apple computers was one of the things that helped build that company's success. Unfortunately, higher education has allowed tech companies to shape the technological consciousness of students. The edtech tools that universities use smuggle in a hidden curriculum of their own, a curriculum that teaches students software oppression is natural and inevitable. As a consequence, higher education has been converted into a pipeline for tech customers, a factory of passive users that have no expectation to being able to control their software. So how did we get here? Did universities always enforce oppressive forms of edtech on students? On one hand, yes, you can trace a long, dark thread about the oppressive use of technology in education. And there are many examples of students using technology and machines as metaphors for dehumanizing forces at play in the university. For example, you can see this in student communications during the free speech movement of the 1960s. And I wanted to play you a clip of this amazing speech. I'm going to read it instead. But a speech given by a student leader named Mario Savio on December 2nd, 1964 at UC Berkeley on the day that 800 students were arrested, which helped bring national attention to the free speech movement. And this part of the speech I'm going to read is where he's advocating for civil disobedience, advocating for the students to keep sitting and not give up their fight against the university administration. And he says, "There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all." He gives a much better delivery. Look it up online. But I'm telling you, I'm referencing this speech because he uses the metaphor of the machine to talk about the political system that is exploiting human beings, the system that he is urging students to resist. And though he's not specifically using a computational metaphor here, his language is closely tied with the way the student movement used computational metaphors as a symbol for the type of controlling, alienating machine that he invokes. There's the link. Anyone know what this is? Yeah, thumbs up, right? The punch card, right? One thing I find fascinating is that the punch card figured really prominently in the free speech movement, in the students' free speech movement's symbols. Now, as you know, the punch card was a key piece of computational technology in the 1960s. And so the punch card was also used to manage people in large institutions like higher education. And if you look at photos of the movement, again, I wish I got the licensing rights to show you. You can find them online. If you look at photos of the movement, you'll find students wearing these punch cards as a badge with the word "strike" punched out in the card. You'll also find cartoons that satirically depict students as punch cards being mass-produced by the university machine. And there's even a well-known anecdote of a student at a protest holding a sign saying, "I am a student of the University of California. Please do not fold, spindle, or mutilate me." It was funny, right? Which, of course, echoes the handling instructions of punch cards themselves. For these students, computing is synonymous with control and alienation. And there are two things I think are notable about this. One, educational technology has had an oppressive dimension long before the advent of ubiquitous digital surveillance. But two, there's a question. Why do students so quickly reach for computing metaphors to describe oppressive forces? It's almost as if they've never been exposed to a mode of computing that puts human freedom at its core. Educational technology has essentially taught them that computers are inherently oppressive. And this is a theme that continues throughout the decades in edtech. There's a growing body of critical research that shows the dark side of edtech history. And if you're interested in learning more on this subject, there's a fascinating book by Audrey Waters called Teaching Machines. And I think this research is really helpful for understanding why edtech looks the way it does today. But I think it's equally important to recognize that there is another history of edtech, a lost history of edtech, which would be worthwhile to recover, a history of edtech projects that resist software oppression, and that they strove, often unknowingly, to embody software freedom, to enact software that is governed and shaped by the user community. And for example, in the late 1970s and 1980s, before corporate software dominated higher education, there were all sorts of educators outside of computer science experimenting with different possibilities of using computers for teaching and learning. I personally have been fascinated with EdTech projects built during this period by writing instructors. They're a really interesting group. A majority of them were not programmers and were even discouraged by their field to engage with computing, but nonetheless, through collaboration or grit, they began building their own tools. And these tools were based on humanistic and educational research. And as a consequence, they looked completely different than the standard writing technologies we've seen in the last 40 years. Students were also often part of the development process. And there are anecdotes that some of these tools were so beloved by students that they wrote songs and poems about them. So what could such wonderful writing tools look like? Do you want me to show you one? Okay, good, because I am going to. okay, so this is the source code for a tool called Topoi, built by Hugh Burns when he was a graduate student in 1979. And it's basically just a chatbot, but it's based on Aristotle's theories of rhetoric. And this tool was designed to chat with students about their writing topic, to help them think about new ways of writing and expressing and thinking about that topic. It's actually pretty funny. Here's a clip from an example chat where the student says, "I'm writing about the fear of death." And the chatbot responds, "Holy electronics, that's weird. I used to date a computer interested in the fear of death." So that's fun. what's really cool about this tool is you can actually try it out now yourself. I mentioned this tool about 3 years ago, and a Mozilla developer in the audience ended up recreating it. Basically tracked down the dissertation in the a really blurry PDF online somewhere, which in the back had the source code, and he rebuilt the tool. So I had the pleasure of using it and found it actually quite delightful. I learned all sorts of new ways to think about my subject and enjoyed the process because the humor and the goodwill of the creator were readily apparent in the experience. It was a very different experience than using some of the AI writing assistant tools that you see today. So to me, you know, even though this is a pretty lo-fi tech project, it's a shining example of how different technology can look, right? How much more joyful it can be when it's actually shaped by its users. Unfortunately, these sorts of creative ed tech projects died out as ed tech became an increasingly corporate project, which relied on non-free software, closed source code, and suppressed a culture of tinkering among educators and students. And so you hardly ever hear about these projects today. Most people don't realize there was an entirely different possibility for education technology than the one we live with today. So at the beginning of this talk, I asked you all to think about the experience that brought you to free software. I'm gonna briefly share with you mine. Like a majority of students in the US, I went from kindergarten through college without ever hearing once about free software or experiencing any of these community-generated ed tech tools. And after college, I found myself, perhaps a bit like Mario Savio, so sick and tired of these odious machines that I went through a Luddite phase. Have any of you gone through a Luddite phase? Right? I thought there might be some of you here. Okay. So education had missed the opportunity to show me that computing could be an extension of my community rather than a medium for control and management. So what happened? How did I go from failed Luddite to free software enthusiast? The only reason my beliefs changed is because I went back to graduate school and by complete chance found myself at an institution with a community that was actively involved with free software for education and research. I went to the CUNY Graduate Center, and there was a group of educators there that ran something called the CUNY Academic Commons, a platform where anyone at the school could create websites and forums and share resources. Technologically speaking, it wasn't very fancy. It was just a blogging, messaging, and networking platform built with free software and heroically supported by a very small team. And yet it was so radically different than any form of computing I had ever experienced in all my years of schooling. Whereas most educational technology emphasized student management and discipline, the commons emphasized community and creativity. And there were thousands of sites and forums created by thousands of educators and students in the CUNY system. Some of these sites were course blogs where students could write to a public audience, which, by the way, dramatically changes the quality and purpose of student writing. People use the commons to create personal research sites, public resources, or forums for activist groups. And you could browse these sites, you could learn from them, you could be inspired, and then you could create your own. I found something intrinsically hopeful about this EdTech tool. It was astonishing to see how different education could look when its tools were designed to celebrate rather than police student learning. And I happened to be reading about free software in one of my media courses. I found the ideas compelling, but it was the experience of community-driven software that helped me understand the value of this freedom. And the commons, right, not only was it supported by free software advocates, its entire existence was only possible through the right of a community to access, modify, and share source code. Because of free software, our academic community had the capacity to build our tools. And in turn, these tools enabled a different model of education, one that was more social, creative, experimental, joyful. So if you think back to that story about the wind and the sun competing to take off the man's jacket, you might remember that it was the sun that won. The sun, by warming the man, led the man to take off the jacket by himself. And for me, the CUNY Academic Commons was like the sun. No one had to scare me away from unfree software. I wanted to move towards free software because it provided a more community-oriented experience. And once that clicked for me, I wanted to help shape the EdTech tools. I began working with students and developers on creating new educational technologies that reflected our needs, such as a tool called Social Paper, which allowed students to network their papers for community feedback. So this is the moment when my technological consciousness changed. I was no longer passively accepting technology as it was given, but working with a community to modify it to better support our needs. And before my exposure to free software, I had never imagined that would be possible. I'm not sure where else I would have experienced free software had it not been for education. Professionally, it became very important for me to offer this students the same sort of experience. So after I left the City University of New York, I went to UCSD, and using the same free software that ran the CUNY Academic Commons, created a commons for higher education in San Diego called NIT. And NIT was very similar to the CUNY Academic Commons. It provided a space for research groups to create websites, or we had public archives, we had course projects, forums, collaborative tools, academic blogs. One project I'm really proud of is the Race and Oral History Project, where students actually created oral history archives based on interviews with community members about race. So these were projects that would have never been supported by the learning management systems or plagiarism detection tools, right, that I showed you in the beginning. But what I was most excited about was creating opportunities for students to help shape this platform. So I formed a student research group called NIT R&D. And basically, this was intended to give students an opportunity to respond to critical digital issues by modifying the platform itself. Often there were practical issues that kept us from actually making those changes, but just the idea of being able to design their own ed tech was enough to spark a passion in these students. And they began writing posts about all the exploitative user contracts they had to sign as students, or dreaming up systems that would enable universal access to knowledge regardless of one's institutional affiliation. And so the technological apathy that so many researchers describe seeing in students was nowhere to be found. So I found this very exciting. And this thought that students should have more agency in their ed tech continued to be confirmed as I learned about other kindred ed tech projects that don't get enough attention, but I think really powerfully demonstrate the potential of free software or software freedom in higher education. Let me just quickly point to a few of those. I have 5 minutes, okay. You know, the first one is the Humanities Commons run by Kathleen Fitzpatrick at Michigan State University. Again, it's another commons platform, but it's really accessible and free to anyone to use. They built this tool because they were sick of data surveillance, exploitation by academic publishers, and they wanted to design a tool that better supported social and open forms of research and teaching. Another great example is the Open Ed Tech Collaborative, which is run voluntarily by educational technologists across several institutions in British Columbia. Similarly, they wanted to help educators avoid unethical surveillance forms of ed tech, and also believe that access to source code enables the community to be creators rather than passive users. This community in particular has also become a very powerful voice on edtech issues, doing everything from raising legal funds for edtech critics like Ian Linkletter to persuading institutions to drop unethical tools. There are folks that run amazing blog resources for to help educate folks on some of these issues in digital technology and help them pick alternative or more ethical forms of software. And I want to note, too, that there are also companies doing really important work, like the indie ed tech company Reclaim Hosting, which helps institutions provide free software to its students and educators. And same, like many of the other projects here, their mission is to enable students and educators to have greater control over their tools. Because of time, I'll just skip to the next part here. So these are just a handful of projects. If you're interested in learning more, we can talk after. Are they perfect examples of free software? No, not always, right? Some of these tools use free licenses, some don't. Some of these educational technologists care deeply about software freedom, but many think of their projects in the broader context of open education. Regardless, I think these projects embody a really important part of the spirit of software freedom, right? They enable students to meaningfully experience the difference between using software controlled by others and software shaped by their community. So this should give us hope, but their status should have us worried. These projects are incredibly precarious. And this is a picture of a discarded computer that was revamped to host a secret server for a free software ed tech project that was not supported by campus IT. Don't tell anyone. I may or may not have supported this project. I'm sharing this picture to represent the many challenges there are in running these types of projects. For example, they are often in direct conflict with IT teams who need to enforce certain policies and security measures and often prohibit ed tech that isn't sanctioned by the university. There's often not adequate staff or budgets to support these projects. They're often done voluntarily or bootstrapped through a patchwork of temporary funding. Folks trying to support these tools often experience burnout. These projects are often at odds with school administrators who want the entire student body on one set of tools in order to track analytics to show the institution's academic progress. And students are already overwhelmed by the amount of tools they have to learn to use in education. They often resent being asked to use yet another one. And so many of these projects are incredibly precarious. They point to great possibility, but they are not built on a solid foundation. So I want to return to this image by the artist Diane Twomley to reflect on how we might build a stronger foundation for the future of software freedom. What I've hoped to convey today is that higher education is an important part of that foundation. It is a critical site for shaping our technological future. At the moment, that's scary because edtech is helping normalize digital surveillance and control at mass scale. And yet, as we've seen, there are examples of edtech projects that resist these trends. They show students the profound difference that software freedom can make, not just on their experience as a user, but as a living, thinking, socializing human being. So I want to encourage this community to think about how we might engage with these edtech projects and learn from them, or find other ways to help students and educators experience the value of software freedom. As I can see from the talks ahead, you are all doing amazing work, right? Libre payment systems, jailbreaking the farm, DIY browsers. I think there's a Greek philosopher that's giving a talk tomorrow. Pretty excited about that. So I wonder how we can bring this excitement to students. And then finally, as an educator, I would be remiss to not leave you with a homework assignment. So, right, look around. Everyone here has a story about how they about the experience that led them to free software. And so over the course of the weekend, I invite you to ask each other about these experiences, to share your experience. These are the experiences that we need to figure out how to teach our current generation and the next. Because of course, there will be a test, and the results of that test will be readily apparent in the freedom of our machines. Thank you.
Let's start with a question from IRC. Can you give a specific example of software that helped you? Wait, it's a long. That helped the communities you mentioned.
That helped the community what?
That's what it says.
That just helped the community?
Yeah,
so the first example that springs to mind is the software that powered the CUNY Academic Commons, and that is Commons in a Box, which is stitched together by a variety of different softwares, including WordPress and BuddyPress and some others I'm not recalling. What was so powerful about that tool is it enabled a relatively small team with, you know, not extraordinary technical resources to put together a tool that could, an ed tech tool that could serve thousands of students and compete essentially with the institutional ed tech tools that were not so great.
Thanks so much. That was really great. I appreciate it. My interest in free software is sort of feels like a hobby, but my day job is actually director of instructional technology at a small liberal arts college.
Wow, awesome.
And so my question, again, I really resonated with everything that you said. Fortunately, we're so poor that we haven't bought into a lot of this stuff. So one of the things that means is that our learning management system is Moodle, which is an open source, right? And I've been thinking, oh, it's such a drag that we haven't managed to be able to buy something better, because it is sort of old and clunky. But I would encourage anybody who's interested in what was said, get involved with the Moodle project.
Awesome.
Because, you know, it's something that is not a cloud-based data collection thing.
Yeah.
It's a tool that's along with what you're doing.
That's so awesome. You. Awesome. Thank you for that. Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Hi, I was wondering if you could say how the learning management system software was able to surveil students after they graduated. Were they in collusion with Google monitoring data? How were they able to do that?
That's a great question. I actually don't know the technical details behind that. I just read that in several different research articles. So good question. I'll look into that.
Good afternoon. Good luck in 2 months, I guess, from now.
Thank you.
I'm a high school teacher, right, not far from here. And I'd just like you to reflect. It's not just the colleges, obviously, but if we're looking at a world now where all my students have to look at a Chromebook and click multiple choice questions, and no matter what discipline they're on, we are really killing what we do as teachers is to have a relationship with our kids, to read what they're writing, to look at how they're doing things, and to understand everybody here who has a kid in elementary school, middle school, high school, this is what we're doing to them.
Yeah.
It's everything is Canvas, everything is click, click, click. And that data that they're capturing for our kids is not being used for things like just saying what their standard scores are. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for that. It's terrifying.
Hi, so so I am a state legislator in New Hampshire, and we sometimes get legislation having to do with how education works generally more for primary schools. We don't have quite as much control over the secondary school system, since most of the colleges in New Hampshire are private. But so I was wondering, so when you talk about school administrators having to fight against them because they have policies that are hostile to free software, I'm wondering to what extent are those policies driven by governmental legislative policy making, and is there anything that could be done legislatively to make free software in the classroom more of the ones that IT departments would be wanting to promote instead?
I hope so, and that's a great question, and thank you for asking it. The learning analytics piece came from conversations I've had with folks whose names and institutions I will not divulge, because I don't think they want to be known to have said this. But it's based on administrators coming in and wanting to prove their value so that they can move on to their next job. So having those analytics can be very helpful. But about legislation, I think that's a wonderful question, and I hope we can think about that. Yeah.
Question from IRC.
Yeah.
What would you recommend to students who are forced to use certain software in their education?
That's a really great question. One, and a really frustrating question. When I was in higher education, one response we had to that situation was we created a remixable notice for instructors to put on their syllabus that just made folks aware of the ethical issues around this technology and the data practices. And, you know, again, it wasn't like a solution, but we think maybe the first way of responding to this when you can't actually change things is to at least drive awareness. So that allowed educators to put this on the syllabus, have conversations with students. But good question. Yeah.
Okay, so I guess I'm speaking as someone who I guess still has some Luddite sympathies.
Nice.
Okay, so I think you've done a great job of demonstrating the ways in which technology can be used in ways that are like enhanced freedom, which I mean, I completely agree with. But I guess what I'm wondering is, when we look at the way in which like technology as a whole evolves, like when we look at necessarily the fact that I as a student still have to use Canvas,
yeah,
the majority of students, whether they like it or not, they still have to use Canvas one way or another if they want a degree. And that is like the trajectory for a lot of people. Why should we, I guess, necessarily assume that the course will go any different? Because, I mean, there's a lot of awareness surrounding technology. I mean, we can look even, like, the impact Snowden has had, like, of privacy, all these issues. But at the end of the day, like, what factors, I guess, can we ensure that this sort of, like, awareness or even outrage will translate into anything that actually, like, I guess, changes stuff? Because when I'm, like, constantly, like, having to use, like, Canvas or even, like, use Outlook, I mean, at this point, I'm pretty sure, like, everything is known about me out there. Like, why shouldn't I just be discouraged at this point?
Right. No. I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? I mean, and also can become really, really frustrating, because the amount of energy it takes to work against this current is draining. It's exhausting. And I really backed off during the pandemic because I knew educators and students were just trying to survive, like not, you know, set up Libre systems at home. This is why I think we really need to invest in the positive examples. You know, to be like the sun, to draw people to things that feel good, that nourish us, that nourish our communities, because the wind method, right, the fear method just doesn't seem to be working. So, yeah, thank you.
Hey, thanks for the talk. I thought it was great on every level. And second, I still have my CUNY Academic Commons page from 12 years ago. I just looked.
Oh,
so I did think it was badass. At the time, I was also inspired by it.
We have to talk.
Yeah. But the IRC question about what students should do, I kind of have the opposite. I teach here at Emerson College, and I'm always trying to radicalize my students for, you know, all kinds of left causes. But I want to encourage my students to stand up for their rights and not be spied on. But I noticed with a problem like this, trying to get them to not allow themselves to be videotaped, that seems easy, or maybe Turnitin.com is a maybe case, these plagiarism checkers. I just wonder if you have a suggestion, because I want to advocate this to my students, but is there a good, you know, we have something like the four essential freedoms, like if I want to tell a rando about free software, I can say that and it's like striking. Do you have a good like short principled sell case, like students, this is the line that shouldn't be crossed, because maybe it's above Turnitin.com or maybe it's below it, but definitely we don't want videotaping students and analyzing their faces. I hope the question's clear.
Yes, no, that we need like a student elevator pitch.
Yes.
Yes, that's a great idea. I do not have one. We should come up with one together.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Great talk, and nothing personal about the gesture earlier, more about how I feel about that software. On the flip side, my sister was a secondary graduate school instructor for ESL, and she actually had the experience of really bad plagiarism where she had assignment to her students to write a paper on why plagiarism was bad. And she said 25% of her students handed in stuff that was copied right out of their own class textbook.
Like, at least be smart about it, right?
Yeah, that was kind of her response, was like, at least look up plagiarism from somebody else's textbook.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's so depressing. That's a wonderful point, and I'm still connected to many educators who are saying this is a huge problem, and of course, right, with all these AI writing bots, it's going to get even worse. Even one of my friends who is a diehard free software educator in the classroom, only uses Libre software in the classroom, has become really depressed. He says, actually, the only culture of free sharing my students are really into is plagiarism, right? Yeah. Right? I was like,
And I will say that one of the things that I spent some time doing substitute teaching myself, and I got handed, you know, a lot of the keep them busy and entertained because you're not expected to really teach course material.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was doing an awful lot that was violating copyright in terms of like the videos that they were handing me to show my students that the classroom was teaching them to plagiarize.
Right.
So it's kind of, it's a very mixed culture. And the other one is, it's like, as soon as you go into the work world, what do they want you to do? Collaborate with your fellow employees. Why is it then a crime to collaborate with your fellow students?
So, yeah, it's a good point. I mean, one thing that my response, I guess, to this question is maybe we can design technologies that incentivize not plagiarizing, right? Like, so these public writing spaces, you know, maybe there's more of a reason to genuinely put yourself into the writing assignment because you're connecting with people. If it's just for a grade, if it's just for a learning management system that no one will see, of course I'm going to plagiarize. Like, no one's actually reading it.
Like I say, you know, I've also heard of the old jokes about education degrees that they grade your thesaurus by weight.
Thank you.
First of all, thank you so very much. I would like to say a little bit about parenting.
Thank you.
So congratulations, first of all. So I'm the father of four daughters who range in age from 30 down to 19. All four of them were sent to college with a GNU Linux-based laptop, despite some of the challenges associated with that. And parenting, I'm not sure if this is your first or not, but it's a very powerful thing, how protective you feel toward your offspring. And when somebody steps forward and says, I want to violate that person in a weird sort of way, like I want to put a camera in their bedroom for these reasons. And it's like, yeah, I can understand your motivation that if you're doing interior design, wouldn't it be wonderful to see a bunch of interiors in houses across the United States. But you know what? That is not as valuable as other things. So I had a conversation with my daughter, who's actually here with me, and she had to have a proctored thing, of course, this pandemic. She's just finishing high school. She's now in college. And she said, Dad, I don't like this, that they are all these rules on this proctoring and so forth. And we kind of compromised. We moved her into our bedroom outside of hers. Mm-hmm. And I said, Montana, if you want to take a stand, a principled stand on this, I will back you 100%, but it's got to be your choice. But so you get a student, they're young and so forth. It's hard to stand up.
Yeah.
It is hard to stand up. So I would really, really encourage parents to dig in and stand up for our children. This is our children and our children's futures. They deserve to know exactly all of the software that's running on their systems, all the data that's collected. Enough is enough.
Thank you.
Ask a question about the IT departments and some of their reticence. How much of that reticence do you think is coming from a number of features where they're saying, hey, here's this cool thing, here's that cool thing, and we have these charts and graphs at the end? And how much of it is them looking over at their neighbors and going, ah, this is what's popular, and this is what other people are doing, and this is what I've been exposed to, so let's roll with it?
That's a great question. And I should have been clear. IT departments are great. They are not the problem, right? I think they are bound by rules and just also capacity, right? They're trying to support an entire institution. I understand why they don't want, you know, to support all these custom rolled different tools. So I think it's just a broad range. Sure, it's what they're used to, what they are skilled in, but it's also a lot of policies that the university enforces, and they just sometimes their hands are bound. They are not able to support other types of projects. So, yeah, thanks. Great question.
So, Canvas is sort of technically a GPL licensed, but there's a lot of, you know, privacy concerns with Canvas. So I guess, how do we ensure going forward as we make new tools to replace these invasive widespread things, that they don't just devolve back into what we have now? Because I think that's kind of the promise of Canvas over Blackboard, was that it was a little bit more open. And then now I've used both Canvas and Blackboard. Canvas is a lot worse to use, and it seems like it has the same privacy concerns.
That's a great question. I think we need to see more governance, and we need to start cultivating cultures of engaged, yeah, governing bodies of university IT that includes students. And it's not just about, like, do we like this product or not? Like, does it work on, you know, different types of machines? It's more like, does it, what are our ethics? And does it respect user privacy? You know, I think we need to come up with documents like that. Yeah.
Thanks.
With that, like, let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.